Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with David Stuttard about his biography of the Athenian politician and general Alcibiades, entitled Nemesis, Alcibiades and the Fall of Athens. David, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. Well, I am a classicist and a historian. I also have a great interest in ancient theatre, and indeed had my own theatre company that specialised in the plays of Aeschylus and Euripides and Sophocles and so on. I studied classics at St Andrews University. And since 2010, really, have been a published author, writing a number of books on ancient history and also ancient literature as well.
That background, I think, really comes across in your book, because one of the things you do, which I thought was especially enlightening, was how you situate your subject in some of the plays of the time, showing how he has this cultural impact. And it was one of the things that I thought was really interesting about your book, was how you bring the era to life in a way that makes it very relatable for readers today. And I thought that was very interesting. What was it that led you to choose Alcibiades as a subject?
Well, I think I've always been interested in Alcibiades ever since I can remember, really. He really is such a fascinating individual. He's a man who, both in his own era, really, and today, really appears to epitomize the period of ancient Athens, when Athens was at its height, and then, because of its own hubris, in a sense, engineered the circumstances under which it allowed itself to be undermined and eventually defeated at the end of the Peloponnesian War. Alcibiades was a man of great. He was born into a very high powered Athenian family, and I think he was right from the start aware of his own ancestry and his own abilities. Part of his abilities, quite incidental in a way, was that he just happened to be the handsomest man in Athens, and really sort of reveled in the fact that people enjoyed his company. He seems to have been a phenomenally magnetic, charismatic personality. But as I say, he was born into almost the aristocracy of ancient Athens. We really tend to think of Athens as this great democratic society. But even at the height of its democracy, it was controlled or steered, if you like, heavily influenced, certainly, by a handful of aristocratic families, among which were the Alcmaeonidae, the Alcmaeonids. This was a family who could really could trace its history back hundreds of years. For many generations, they'd been the movers and shakers of ancient Athens. They'd had great victories in the horse races and the chariot races at the Olympics and other great pan-Hellenic festivals. And Alcibiades, at a very young age, maybe 4 or 5 years old, was orphaned. His father was off on a military expedition against the Thebans, who live just a little to the northwest of Athens, and he was killed in an ambush. And as a result of this, Alcibiades was given to be looked after by arguably the most famous politician of classical Athens, the great Pericles. So he was educated and looked after in Pericles' house for all of his formative years, until he inherited his father's wealth at the age of 18, when he became an ephebe, which is the term that we use really for a young Athenian who's in that transitional period between boyhood and adulthood. It's a time also we believe that Alcibiades would have been trained in the army. And at just this period, this is the late 430s BC, the great Peloponnesian war between Athens and her empire and Sparta and her allies erupts. And at the age of 18 or so, Alcibiades is himself involved in a great military expedition up to Potidaea, which is up near modern Thessaloniki. Potidaea was a city which had a strange sort of in-between relationship with Athens. It was part of Athens' empire, but it was also governed by one of Athens' enemies, oddly enough, and it rebelled, and the Athenians really tried to get it back again under the empire. And for a couple of years, they're all up there besieging Potidaea. It's at this particular stage when Alcibiades first hits the headlines, if you like, for his acts of military courage. We hear that he plunges into battle. He gets into to difficulties and is only actually saved in the end by another great friend and associate of his, the philosopher Socrates. Now, Alcibiades and Socrates appear to have enjoyed a very close relationship. Indeed, it's arguably partly because of their relationship with Alcibiades that Socrates, in the end, is charged with having a bad influence on the young men of Athens. Alcibiades is one of these aristocrats who the people of Athens eventually believed were responsible for effectively overthrowing the constitution of Athens at the end of the Peloponnesian War. And because of that relationship, and because maybe Alcibiades is involved in the background, if you like, of the execution of the philosopher. The relationship between him and Socrates is very problematic, because once Socrates had been executed, there were those who tried very hard to say, well, actually, he didn't have such an influence over Alcibiades at all. If only Alcibiades had actually paid attention to what the philosopher was trying to educate him in, you know, he would have ended up a much better individual, and none of this awful stuff would have happened. But anyway, that's a whole other story. Alcibiades then returns to Athens after the end of the siege. Athens has already changed a little bit because, as I say, the Peloponnesian War is now really taking over the whole of the Western Greek world, really, the mainland and the islands too. And but another thing which has happened to Athens is that this great plague has arrived, and a third of the population of Athens is struck to the town and doesn't actually survive this. So right at the beginning of Alcibiades' adulthood, the world of Athens is undergoing a massive change. We know that by the time Alcibiades is in his 30s, early 30s, at a time again which is very important for him, for a politician, because this is a time when a man is able to become a military commander. I'm sure that Alcibiades really thought that it was in the army and the military that his, you know, his hopes lay of achieving this great idea of excellence. The poems of Homer, the Iliad of Homer especially, appear to have motivated ancient Greek aristocrats. And at the heart of the Homeric creed is the idea always to be the best and to excel over all others. And I think it was Alcibiades' desire always to excel over all others that drove him. The problem was, when he came of age to become a military commander, Athens and Sparta decided that they'd had enough of the Peloponnesian War, and it appeared that they were entering, they actually signed a peace treaty, which theoretically should have lasted for 50 years in all. Now, that, of course, wasn't in Alcibiades' interests at all. So he did his best to foment antagonism between the two great cities, while at the same time building his own reputation. Part of this process of building his own reputation was really to do with, I mentioned earlier, his ancestors had really done so spectacularly well. Enter team of a four-horse chariot team into the Olympics, and in 416 BC, Alcibiades entered not only one four-horse chariot team, not even two or three, but seven four-horse chariot teams into the Olympics. No one had ever been so wealthy or so ostentatious that they were able to enter as many as that. And I think from what we know, that no one would ever enter as many again. The result was obvious. Alcibiades came in first, because I think this is an interesting part of his personality. Not only was he determined that he would win in this race, but by entering all of those other chariots, he could maneuver his other chariots in such a way that he could really impede anybody else who was in the race. So this was a very sort of military, tactical way of really doing this. And of course, this helped his reputation no end.
I was wondering if we could take what Alcibiades' life at this point and look at two different things, because one of the things you do in this book is you set it within the context of its times, and you've already alluded to these techniques that he's adopted towards increasing his appeal, reaching out to Athenians, trying to bolster his stature. But and you also have talked in passing about some aspects of his personality, and yes. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit more upon who Alcibiades was as a person, what it was that his contemporaries found so striking about him, and how the institutions in which he operated and how he sought to really use those institutions to advance himself. Like, why was chariot racing such a valuable way of reaching out and appealing to the population as a whole?
Well, that's a very interesting question, actually. Maybe we'll answer that one first of all, if we may. The Olympics were an opportunity for people from all over the sort of the pan-Hellenic world. And remember that the Greek world at this stage really stretched from Spain in the west right to Byzantium in the east, and to North Africa as well, and everywhere in between. So, in other words, there was this great Greek diaspora. But how they really preserved their identity was by coming together, or at least those who were able to afford to would come together to great festivals on the mainland and on one of the islands as well. And you would really get athletes coming to the Olympics, obviously, but also, politicians and philosophers and authors would all congregate at Olympia every four years. And this was a chance for, aspirant politicians like Alcibiades to meet and show off, effectively, before politicians of other often hostile, cities. And it was also a chance for other individuals and islanders, for example, to really show their approval of individuals like Alcibiades. So, for example, we hear that the islands of Chios and Samos in the Aegean paid for the fodder for Alcibiades' horses, or paid for the food that he used to entertain the spectators at the Olympics. This was an opportunity. In other words, it's not only an athletics game. It's a game of politics as well. And you were asking about Alcibiades' personality. I think that this great charisma that we hear about really must have played a part in it. But we also hear about how Alcibiades was great at engineering situations in which people would speak about him in the way that he he was keen that they should speak about him in. He evidently wandered through the Agora in Athens, the great market square of Athens, trailing his cloaks in the mud. And these were, you know, hugely expensive outfits he was wearing. And just really to give off this aura of being this great wealthy man who didn't really care because he had it all. And we also hear about another tale when he had this magnificent hunting hound. Everybody was speaking about it all the time, saying, have you seen that lovely, lovely hound? And then there was one day he came into the market place and he'd hacked off its tail. And people said, you know, why did you do this? Everybody's talking about this, Alcibiades. He said, well, I did this in order that they would speak about this and they wouldn't talk about anything else that I might do that they wouldn't actually approve of. You know, you could imagine him in a political problem, you know, at a time of political troubles, waking up one morning and thinking, how do I you know, take the heat off me? Oh, I'll send out a tweet about, you know, something completely unrelated, which will get everybody speaking about that. You know, the parallels with modern politicians, I think, are quite remarkable.
It I think that also comes across in the way that he disrupts this process, as you describe. He there's this verge of a truce between Sparta and Athens, and because it doesn't serve his interests, he disrupts it. How then does he insert himself into the campaigns, and how successful is he in his involvement in the war against Sparta?
Well, during this piece that we were speaking about earlier, he has a period in which he allies himself with Argos, which is had been an independent state, really. It hadn't been involved in the Peloponnesian War at all. But he deliberately helps Argos to build up an alliance of its own, which is an anti-Spartan alliance. So he's always really niggling away at the Spartans. But when that's unsuccessful, he persuades the people of Athens that really what they need to do is to send an expedition westwards against the island of Sicily. The Athenians had always had an interest in Sicily. There were Ionian foundations on the island of Sicily that Athens had alliances with. And in fact, they'd actually send out a number of expeditions across there during the earlier part of the Peloponnesian War. But Alcibiades, in 416 and 415 especially, allies himself with people who come across from a couple of the Sicilian cities, asking Athens for military help. And Alcibiades gets up in the popular assembly and is able, by really painting this very romantic picture of just exactly what they could achieve if they do send this expedition over, achieving in terms of annexing parts of the island, of being able to, you know, accrue great wealth. He's able to make the people of Athens very, very keen indeed on this expedition. And had he been unopposed, things could have ended up very differently indeed. The problem was there was another politician and a member of the older generation who hated Alcibiades, I think, and he really stood up also in the assembly and said, look, this expedition will not succeed. If, in order to make it succeed, we'd have to send at least twice the number of ships, at least twice the number of the army over there to Sicily. You know, we simply shouldn't be thinking of this at all. But he hadn't really gauged the atmosphere successfully at all. The Athenians said, well, in that case, you can have as many ships as you want, as many soldiers as you want, off you go. And what had really begun as a small-scale, you know, expedition turned into this great bloated affair, which immediately even allies in Italy and Sicily really were aware of what was happening. They became very, very nervous indeed, because they thought that an expedition which was as big as that was aiming to annex the whole thing. And so right from the beginning, because of this intervention, the whole flavor of what was being planned changed. And then, of course, what else happened on the eve, virtually on the eve of the expedition setting sail, Alcibiades' enemies managed to involve him in a couple of religious candles. Many of the statues of Hermes, which used to stand outside houses and public buildings, they had a kind of an apotropaic effect. They were supposed to, you know, protect the houses that they were standing outside. Anyway, one morning, Athens woke up to discover that the vast majority of these homes had been smashed, which was thought to be an ill omen, a committee was established. And it had it offered immunity to anyone who came to it with any accusations at all to do with anything to do with irreligious behavior. And of course, at this moment, Alcibiades' enemies thought, wow, this is just exactly the moment that we're looking for, because of his, you know, playboy a reputation, because also, interestingly enough, the family of the Alcmaeonids, to whom he belonged, had an age-old reputation for being impious themselves. Everything stacked up against Alcibiades. And although he was allowed to leave Athens with the expedition, very shortly afterwards, once it had left Athens and Alcibiades wasn't actually in Athens anymore to argue his own innocence. So after a week or two, they decided that they really needed to get him home again to answer some tricky questions. When Alcibiades heard this, he knew that his enemies really had the upper hand, and so it was then that arguably the most interesting parts of his sort of political career begin to happen, because really realizing that Athens was getting a little too hot for him, he absconded from the people who'd been sent out to arrest him, and the next we hear of him, he's with Athens' enemy, the Spartans. He's in Sparta, offering to help the Spartans in any way he can.
You point out in the book early on, though, that there are these signs that point to this Spartan background, this Spartan ancestry, perhaps, in terms of his name and so forth. And I find that interesting, the idea that that the labels of Athenian Spartan may not have been as fixed as we sometimes like to think, and that for somebody like Alcibiades, it would seem that in this situation that it would be only natural for him to start thinking about Sparta as the alternative, and not just simply a matter of, as it might seem to our more nationalistic mindset today, that he is flipped and gone over to the opposite, you know, the hated enemy altogether.
Yes, that's interesting. Yes, he has connections in Sparta, as you say. Even the name Alcibiades is a Spartan name, and his grandfather had been effectively, although it's not exact. I mean, you can't actually translate these things exactly, but he'd been almost the Spartan ambassador in Athens, or at least he'd been the man who'd looked after Spartan interests in Athens. So there is this great connection between Alcibiades and Sparta. But there's another thing too, I think, and that is, we mentioned Homer and the Iliad a little earlier, and that idea, which is exemplified by Achilles in the Iliad, always to be the best and to surpass all others. Another thing which happens with Achilles, you'll remember in the Iliad, is that when Agamemnon and the army try to humiliate him in his eyes, he withdraws from the fighting at Troy. But that's not all he does. There's a passage in the Iliad in which we hear Achilles asking his mother Thetis to go up to Mount Olympus and ask the great god Zeus to avenge Achilles by, and here's the crucial thing, ensuring that the Greeks should endure hardships. The Greek army would be defeated, and because they were really doing so badly, they would eventually come to the realization that they needed to have Achilles back again, so that they would ask him to, you know, come and help them. And in a sense, I think that this is really what Alcibiades has in mind as well, because even though he leaves Athens, we really see him in the period afterwards always trying to find a way to get home again. And often enough, that is because he's helping the enemy. But he's not just helping the enemy to harm Athens because he hates Athens. It's that very strange relationship he has. I think he's helping the enemy to harm Athens because he really is so keen that Athens will actually realize how important Alcibiades is, and that they would rather have him back on their own side than helping the enemy. So I think he's heavily influenced by this sort of archaic, Homeric, heroic ideal.
One that's, of course, heavily leavened with a sense of his own self-regard.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, behaving almost as if he is a Homeric hero.
So how well does he do for the Spartans? Is he an asset for them? Does he prove to be more trouble than he's worth? How does his relationship with him evolve?
Well, we hear, this is another of those rather problematical things, really, because the main evidence we have, or at least the main contemporary evidence, comes from the histories of Thucydides and his great history of the Peloponnesian War. And it has long been really believed now, and I think this is probably true, that quite a lot of what Thucydides tells us about Alcibiades may have come straight from Alcibiades himself, because we know that Thucydides interviewed all the most important players in the Peloponnesian War at another period when Alcibiades was exiled. He was actually geographically rather close to Thucydides, and it would have made quite a lot of sense, really, for Thucydides to have interviewed him. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that the information we have about just how helpful Alcibiades was in Sparta could well have been exaggerated by Alcibiades. We know that he supposedly gave two pieces of advice, one of which was to become involved in this expedition that the Athenians had sent out to Sicily earlier, and actually to help the enemy, if you like, the people that Athens were fighting. And the other piece of advice was to occupy part of Attica. That's the area around Athens, to provide a place in Attica that the Spartans could use and sort of harass Attica from. Now, that piece of advice was actually something that the Spartans, we hear again from Thucydides, had already been thinking about. Probably the fact that Alcibiades urged them to do it, you know, he was then able to say, "Oh well, it was all my idea to begin with," as he liked to say about a lot of things. But yes, so those actually are the two main pieces of military advice which he gave. He also became involved when envoys began to come from the east, because the great Persian Empire, which had been the great aggressor earlier on in the 5th century BC, when it had invaded the mainland of Greece, it was now beginning to think that it would actually be quite a good idea if it became involved in the Peloponnesian War. If it helps Sparta, in other words, because Athens was always a bit of an annoyance, really. The Athenian Empire, the way that Athens owned, if you like, the Aegean Sea, really didn't appeal to the Persians at all. They really felt that they should be able to have their own ships in the Aegean too, and also to reclaim the area of Ionia on the western coast of Asia Minor that Athens actually controlled at that stage. So the Persians are very keen to come in on Sparta's behalf. And there were two Persian governors, effectively, who were each very keen to enlist the Spartans' help. One of them was the governor of the area of the Hellespont, the area between that narrow strip of water between Asia and the European coastline and also over towards Byzantium. And he was very keen to enlist the Spartans' help, because he realized that Athens really needed to keep that strip of water open. Athens relied very much, because of its great population, on imports. And it imported a lot of grain from the Crimea and that area. And so they had to keep that sea passage open. And the Persians really thought, well, if we are able to close this, we can really starve Athens into submission. Other of the regional governors of the Persians, who was based close to Ephesus, that kind of area down there in Asia Minor, was also very keen to enlist the Persians. And for some reason, I think it's probably to prolong the Peloponnesian conflict, and also because he's always hoping to return to Athens, Alcibiades appears to have been able to persuade the Spartans that he was the man that they ought to enlist the help of. So for the next couple of years, Alcibiades and the Spartans are trying to prise away Athens' allies in the Eastern Aegean and in that Ionian area. And Alcibiades is really successful here. The trouble is, Alcibiades has been up to his old tricks when he's been in Sparta. And we hear that one of the queens of Sparta became pregnant when Alcibiades was there. And when she had her child, and her husband began to do the arithmetic about he hadn't actually slept with her for, you know, longer than it ought to have been, because there'd been an earthquake. He hadn't slept with her ever since the earthquake. She couldn't have been pregnant at the time of the earthquake. Ah, Alcibiades. So the king of Sparta has a personal animosity towards Alcibiades, because it's believed, and in fact the queen sort of adds to this, because evidently in on her own, when she's speaking to this little child, she addresses him as Alcibiades, which is rather a big sort of hint by who the father might be. So the Spartans now have it in for Alcibiades as well. In other words, it's not just the Athenians, it's the Spartans. And when Alcibiades realizes that an order for his execution has been passed in Sparta, he goes over to the Persians. So this is his next period. And he evidently offers the Persians advice too. And his advice to the Persians is, if the Athenians appear to be having the upper hand in the Peloponnesian War, help the Spartans. If the Spartans appear to be having the upper hand, help the Athenians. In other words, prolong the war for as long as you can. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, eventually, because of political upheavals at home in Athens, the army of Athens believes that the only person that they think can possibly help them is Alcibiades. Oddly enough, this is the moment Alcibiades has been sort of hoping for all this time. He's recalled to the army, although it takes him quite a number of campaigning seasons before he allows himself to go back to Athens. He leads Athens' army and navy in some spectacular military campaigns, all of them hugely successful, returns home to Athens, great accolade, wonderful stuff. But the almost immediately he goes out to campaign again. Things go wrong. He realizes that he'll be blamed by his enemies at home in Athens. He takes himself into exile. He lives up in the area up above the Hellespont, Thracian lands there. He lives there as a independent warlord, effectively. At last, in 405, the Athenian navy is badly defeated at the Battle of Aegospotami. Exactly what Athens had been afraid of happened. The Hellespont becomes closed. The grain supply isn't able to get through. Athens is besieged by land and by the Spartans. And eventually in 405, Athens has to capitulate. Alcibiades' enemies at this stage really agree, both his enemies in Athens and his enemies in Sparta, that they have to get Alcibiades out of the picture permanently, because he still has a following in Athens. The people of Athens are still hoping, oh, if only Alcibiades could come back again, everything would be all right. And so Alcibiades goes on the run. Oddly enough, he goes back to the Persians, asks them for, you know, protection, for safe haven. He even appears to have offered that if they allow him access to the great king of Persia, he can help him too. But as he's on the journey towards the Persian heartland, he appears to be sort of held up for quite a long time. Probably the paperwork isn't in order or something like that. And then, of course, we have the great episode that ends his life. He's in this house at night on the high Anatolian plain, and in the middle of the night, those in the house can smell smoke, and the house appears to have been set on fire, or at least the entrance to it has. Alcibiades gets out of bed and sort of they're able to put out the flames initially, but then Alcibiades realizes that the house is totally surrounded, and it's very much like the ending of Butch Cassidy, because Alcibiades, alone and unprotected, throws open the door and runs out into the night, and the arrows begin to fly. And
I love the description that you have at the end about with the women in the house mourning him and wailing and yes, and preparing his body, but there's part of his body that they can't prepare. Because the assassins have to provide proof that they've killed Alcibiades, and there's only one part of the body you can provide that would guarantee that.
His handsome head.
Yes,
indeed. And they take it back and say, "Look, here he is. It's all over. It's all done." And all of that, those details come from Alcibiades' ancient biographer, Plutarch. How true they are, we cannot tell, but it certainly makes for a romantic ending.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, I've just finished a book, actually on a completely different subject, a book on Roman mythology. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book called A Traveler's Guide to Greek Mythology, which really took the reader to different places, which were connected with the Greek myths. So I was asked if I could do a follow-up, if you like, which was about Roman mythology. So that has the same format. I've also just finished collating and editing a collection of essays about the ancient play Ajax, Sophocles Ajax, which I've written a chapter in about Ajax in Greek art, and it uses my English translation of the play as well. And I'm just beginning to write another biography, really, for Harvard University Press. This one's looking at the earlier Greek figure, Kimon, who was a very important figure just after the Persian invasions. In fact, his father was Miltiades, who was very involved in the initial Persian invasion of Athens. He led Athens to victory at the Battle of Marathon. And Kimon then took over from him, if you like, and helped to create the Athenian Empire. So I'm hoping that this will be written by Easter 2020 and out the next year, because 2021 is the 2500th anniversary of the Persian invasions, which involved battles of Thermopylae and so on, a very stirring period in ancient history. So I'm just beginning to immerse myself in that era.
Your fingers must be heavily calloused from all this writing.
Yes, they are. I enjoy it, though. It's a great thing.
Well, David, thank you for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Not at all. Thank you for asking me. I've enjoyed speaking to you. Thanks.